Mickey.
Mickey who?
You know who, the fellow with the celebrated swing.
Good morning. For those of us old enough to have seen Mickey Mantle play baseball, either in person or on television, his play is something we will always remember. His combination of power and speed was something that no one up to that time had ever seen. The mythology surrounding his life has more or less become the truth, as many of us understand it. Dozens of biographies have been written about Mickey Mantle, but none of them are like the one we're going to talk about this morning. The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle and the End of America's Childhood, published by Harper, was written by Jane Levy, an award-winning former sports writer and feature writer for The Washington Post and author of the New York Times best-selling biography of Sandy Koufax. She joins me by phone. Jane Levy, good morning and welcome to the program.
Thanks so much. It's nice to be with you. It may even be warmer where you are than where I am.
Really? How warm is it where you are?
It's about 13, 14 degrees, I think. I'm in Washington,
yeah, I think
D.C.
Okay, well, I think it's a little warmer than that here at the head of the lakes where I'm sitting. There have been quite a few biographies written about Mickey Mantle. Why write another one?
Well, you know, originally I wanted to do Mickey, Willie, and the Duke in New York in the 50s. And recreate that time, that golden era in New York sports and the golden era of baseball, where the surfeit of talent seemed almost as big as the city. And when I proposed that to the publisher, HarperCollins, they said, not so much. They said, you know, well, Willie's kind of difficult to talk to, and Duke, you know, he's getting up there. Do the Mick. Everybody loves the Mick. And whatever doubts I had were probably resolved the other day when I was walking by the Steuben Glass showroom on Madison Avenue in New York. And this big display of Mickey Mantle memorabilia there with a hand-blown glass. And I asked the store manager, you know, why? Why are you doing this in the middle of winter? And he said, well, it's true. People really don't talk about baseball very much in winter, but they always talk about Mickey Mantle.
Yeah, why is that? What is it, what was it about Mickey Mantle that created such a huge impression on people who weren't even Yankees fans? I mean, I grew up hating the Yankees, but I loved Mickey Mantle.
Yeah, I think he transcended locality. I think he transcended even hatred of the Bombers, the Bronx Bombers. And I think part of it had to do, you know, when I asked the same question to virtually all 563 people I spoke to, part of it had to do with that fabulous coast-to-coast smile that seemed to embrace a kind of unique American optimism that characterized the early 50s and post-World War II America when, you know, we had geared up and the industrial power of the country was brought to bear to defeat Japan and Germany, and then to rebuild Europe. And everything seemed possible. We could do anything, make anything, even a Mickey Mantle, a talent so unsurpassed, you know, an unprecedented alloy of speed and power from both sides of the plate. So I think he touched the sense of optimism. I think he touched the other great American myth of a meritocracy, because we really wanted to believe that there was always going to be a Tom Greenwade, you know, who would stumble past a little ballpark by the side of the Spring River, crossing from Kansas, Baxter Springs, Kansas, into Missouri, and that a young guy who wasn't his full, you know, dimension yet, who couldn't field shortstop very well, that, you know, something about your talent would insist upon being recognized, and that there would be somebody to recognize you. And that's, of course, what we all want to believe, whether we're Betty Grable at the, you know, soda fountain, or a little boy who spent every afternoon swinging the bat for his grandfather and father.
Mm-hmm. The subtitle contains a phrase, "The End of America's Childhood." Explain what you mean by that.
Well, I have a photograph hanging in my house that was given to me for my 35th birthday I don't want to tell you quite how long ago that was.
We'll assume it was last year.
Thank you very much. And I used it in the book, and it's a picture of Mickey Mantle surrounded by his guys, Billy Martin and Whitey Ford. And they're middle-aged, and Mickey's sitting there in his pinstripes at an old-timers day, actually at Shea Stadium when the Yankees were tenant farmers over there. And the pinstripes are gapping at the middle, and he's got big mutton chop, you know, sideburns and period pieces, to say the least, and his cap is pushed back on that brow the way it always was. But he's got this goofy Jerry Lewis look on his face, as if he's a kid out on the playground making fun of somebody at recess. And I looked at the dissonance between the corporeal guy, the aging guy, and the goofy, you know, boy look on his face, and said, he's the last boy. And he's the last boy who played at a time when we played against the old set of rules that said, boys will be boys, and boys got to do what boys got to do. And we winked and we smiled and we said, that's okay. We'll forgive them for being themselves. That's what boys got to do.
Okay. I want you to, in the introduction that you wrote to this book, you tell a story about a sweater, and I want you to tell our listeners that story because it's a great story.
I was a reporter at the Washington Post in 1983 when Mickey signed a contract to be a greeter. Officially, his title was Director of Sports Promotions at a hotel in Atlantic City called the Claridge, which happened to be the place where my parents had their one-night honeymoon on December 25th, 1941, before my father shipped out to the Aleutian Islands. And when Mickey signed on there, he was promptly banished from baseball, as had Willie Mays been when he signed with Bally's across the street. And Commissioner Bowie Kuhn, who ruled that, you know, this kind of conduct was detrimental to the game, as if signing autographs there was any more pernicious than signing them at spring training with a fake title, you know, batting instructor, it banished him. And Mickey needed the job. He needed the money, $100,000 a year, because I had learned one of his four sons, Billy, was dying of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the disease that killed Mickey's father, Mutt, and which he spent a lifetime anticipating would be his fate. And I get there early, and I'm nervous, because Mickey's my guy. You know, growing up in New York, you had to have a guy, even if you were a little girl who wore party shoes to opening day of the baseball season. And if you were that little girl, as I was, whose grandmother lived two blocks from home plate in the building called the Yankee Arms, Mickey was your guy. So I'm waiting for him, and he turns up 2 hours late. Clearly, bloodshot eyes attested to the long night he had had before. And he sticks out his hand. He says, hi, I'm Mick. And I said, hi, I'm nervous. And he said, why? Did you think I was going to pull on? And he named a tender part of one's anatomy that you don't want to have pulled on by anyone, certainly not your hero in a public place. And I was devastated. In that instant, my childhood came crashing to a halt. Now, you could say it was about time. I was 32 years old. But nonetheless, we all carry these illusions with us about who these guys are and then are disappointed by them over and over again. But then a funny thing happened. We went out on a golf course where he was doing this media day, and a gale was blowing off the Atlantic. It was late April, and it was freezing, and I was shivering. I wasn't dressed. I dressed up for Mickey that day, but not for the weather, and I was riding shotgun with him in his golf cart. And he looked at me, and he said, when we stopped before beginning the back nine, can't somebody get this girl a sweater? She's going to bleep and freeze. And nobody moved, because nobody could move, because everybody was frozen. And so he reiterated it. And finally, a sweater appeared. And it was a Mickey Mantle invitational golf tournament sweater, road trip, Yankee gray, V-necked, in the Perry Como style of the era, made of a substance I guarantee you Adam and Eve never encountered, 100% virgin orlon acrylic. And and he gave it to me, and I put it on, and it warmed every part of me, most especially my heart, because this was the other Mickey. This was the guy who had the ability to step outside that bubble of greatness and celebrity and to see me as I was, small and cold and shivering. And that may be the single hardest thing for I think, a celebrity of that magnitude to do. And it was an authentically warm gesture. And so when I began this book, I took the sweater out of the closet, I hung it on the door to my office, and I made myself look at it every morning before I sat down to write and every evening when I quit work, because I wanted to remember that my job was to find the man who fit the sweater and that he wasn't one-dimensional. He wasn't all boorish and crude. He was also a man capable of great kindness and gentleness.
Your biography focuses on some of the seminal events in Mantle's life and career. Talk about how you organized this work and why you chose to do it that way.
Sure. I recognized, because of that experience that I just described to you and because of my very long-lasting childhood infatuation with the Mick, that the only way I could write this book honestly was to tell that story, which, of course, I couldn't tell in 1983 because we didn't write those things then. So I also recognized that how much had been written about him and that I wasn't interested in replicating everything that had already been done. Mickey has inspired what my friend Rich Sandomir at the New York Times calls Mick Lit. I think I quit counting at 26 biographies and autobiographies written for, by, and about him. So I really wanted to do something different. So I took those Atlantic City days I spent with him and chopped them up into parts to make it the framework of the book, and inserted between them chapters detailing 20 days of his life and career that represented high points, low points, and most especially turning points. And yes, some of them are pure baseball. The 1953 tape measure home run he hit here in Washington out of Griffith Stadium, just a couple of miles from where I live. And yes, the great facade shot of 1963, and a chapter that is all about kinetics and how he used his body and how he was able to generate the power he did, which was remarkable, given that he was really only 5'10 and a half and 195. And yes, also emotional turning points. The day his father died, May 6th, 1952, the day that he went to see Dr. Max Jacobson, the guy known in New York for to celebrities far and wide as Dr. Feelgood, because he shot people up with amphetamines and was later condemned by the New York State Board of Regents, had his medical license taken away because of the concoctions he was giving to, you know, stars of stage, screen, and 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He did this service for John F. Kennedy and Jacqueline Kennedy. And Mel Allen had sent Mickey to Dr. Feelgood in September 1961 when an alleged cold had migrated from his chest to his head to his eye and then finally somehow his buttock. And that was the tableau that we all remember of him trying and being unable to run the bases in the 61 World Series. And it was the reason that he basically had to bow out of the home run chase for Babe Ruth's crown against Roger Maris. And there's no evidence at all that, and I'm not suggesting that he got amphetamines from Dr. Feelgood. I think he got a gigantic shot of penicillin in his tuchus because he had contracted what we like to call a social disease.
You You conducted more than 500 interviews with family, friends, teammates. What was their reaction when they found out you were doing a book about Mantle, and how have they responded to the work now that it's out?
Well, many of the teammates that I interviewed who, you know, were most important to me and to the telling of the story have passed on. Hank Bauer and Johnny Blanchard, for example. Jerry Lumpy, who was with the Yankees and then with the Kansas City A's, and other players who played against him, like Bill Fisher, for example, who gave up that fabulous shot off the facade of Yankee Stadium in May 63, have been really kind, and it's meant a tremendous amount to me, because getting the baseball stuff right, and I don't mean, you know, the facts and the figures, and that's hard enough because, as it turns out, they're not always accurate, and the old newspaper accounts don't necessarily jibe with each other, and it's so easy to make those kinds of mistakes. But their sense that I was able to capture what he did and how he did it, and then what he did to himself, the self-destructiveness of this, you know, stupendously talented man, has meant a lot to me. I have not heard from his family, so I can't tell you their reaction. What I promised them, and I interviewed his sons, Danny and David, who are the two surviving Mantle sons, and his wife, Merlin, before she died in the summer of 2009. What I promised them was that I would redeem him from caricature. Mickey had become like just a few other surpassing American icons, so big, so distorted in size and scope, that he was, he referred to himself as a cartoon in that story he wrote after he got out of the Betty Ford Center in the spring of 1994. He said he was a cartoon. He didn't even recognize himself. And so I wanted to give him back human dimension and to give him back his humanity. And that meant, you know, surely the bright, warm spots. I wasn't the only one to whom he gave sweaters and things. He gave away stuff like crazy. He gave Jerry Lumpy 10 sports jackets, cashmere, all tan, when he handed him the keys to his house in New Jersey in Jerry's rookie year, 1957. Merlin and the boys had gone back home. Mickey didn't want to stay out in Jersey by himself. Surely he preferred the big lights of the Great White Way. But in fact, he gave Jerry Lumpy and his wife his house rent-free, and when he got there, there were 10 sports jackets, and Jerry said, Mickey, you forgot your sports coats. Oh, you take them. It's no big deal, you know, and Jerry took them. I said, did you wear them? He said, yeah, I wore them, and I said, well, did they fit? And he said, it wouldn't have mattered.
We're talking about Mickey Mantle. A new biography of Mickey Mantle is just out. The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle and the End of America's Childhood, and the author of that book is with us this morning, Jane Levy. I'm wondering if you have questions that you'd like to ask about Mickey Mantle. I've got a whole list, pages, in fact, but it's not about me, it's about you. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number to call to join the program. You can also reach us via email, talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. And we're on Facebook as well. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page and leave a comment there. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR.
Catch him and pitch a little woo. I love Mickey.
Mickey who?
Mickey you.
Mickey me.
As I get the story, your dad was the one that was primarily responsible for you becoming a switch hitter. Is that right?
That's right, Lou. I guess I was about 6 years old when he started me doing that. He would come home from work and he would pitch right-handed to me, and then my grandfather would pitch left-handed to me.
The part that amazes me concerning yourself at the plate is the tremendous power that you have both as a left-handed hitter and a right-handed hitter. How do you account for that?
Well, I guess it's just natural feeling I have both ways, because I've batted that way so long, I guess.
We're talking about Mickey Mantle this morning. The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle, and the End of America's Childhood is a new biography of Mickey Mantle written by Jane Levy, and we have Jane Levy with us. We just heard a clip of Mantle talking about being a switch hitter. Talk about how his father and grandfather shaped him as a created him as a baseball player in a way. They were really pretty intense in the way they brought him up to play ball.
Yeah, his cousin Max told me, you know, he had to be home at 4 p.m. standing by that rickety shed that all Mantle fans, you know, have heard about. It's corrugated metal shed that was in the front of their house in Commerce to take batting practice. And there was no, you know, everybody knew when Mutt came home from work, playtime was over. And they had him stand out there and hit balls until, you know, Lovell said they had to come in for dinner. And Mutt was a semi-pro ball player, and his grandfather, Charlie, was also a ball player. And one was lefty, one was righty, and they pitched to him every day. And he had no choice about whether to do it. Certainly he was a young boy who was eager to please, and he had the undivided attention of his father, which had to be both helpful in terms of forming him and forging him as this great talent, but also, you know, psychologically, he got all the attention. By the time his twin brothers, who he always said had as much talent and speed as he did, came along, Mutt Mantle was already, you know, a dying man. So Mickey was... He got the benefit of Mutt's best years, and he came home and found him one day, stopped by a local baseball field, and saw him batting right-handed against a right-handed pitcher. And that was a no-no, and Mutt let him have it. There were no two ways about it, what Mickey was going to do, what game he was going to play, how he was going to bat, He skipped his high school graduation the night he graduated in May 1949 from Commerce High School because Mutt and I thought it was more important, and Mickey may well have agreed, to go perform for Tom Greenway, the Yankee scout, that day. Now, you know, Mutt also decided, you know, to accept the contract that was pathetic that Tom Greenway finally offered, you know, $1,500. Wow. And Mutt also decided who he would marry and when he would marry her. And they weren't necessarily bad choices. In fact, they were probably very good ones, but they weren't Mickey's. And as a parent, I know that when you make all the decisions for a kid, inevitably they don't know how to make them good ones anyway for themselves. And I think much of what happened to Mickey is explained by the fact that his father imposed every choice and all the structure on his life. And then suddenly, in May 1952, he was gone, dead at age 40 of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And Mantle was left with all of Mutt's financial responsibilities for the four younger brothers and sisters that he had and the mother who lived till age 94. So it was definitely a mixed bag. When you talk to, as I did, the Nobel Prize winner Eric Kandel, who knows more about memory than anyone else on the planet, I think, about what makes a Mozart, or makes Mantle, they talk about, and it is assumed that you have to have the right genetic makeup here and the right, you know, physiology, but they talk about the inherent need for repetition at an early age, because actually brains grow. We used to think they didn't, but they can show that with a violinist, for example, the hand that is doing the bowing is a different size and has more space, has more, you know, chip size in the brain than the hand that's not doing so much. And so it's very interesting that which, you know, baseball parents, skating parents, tennis parents, all those people who we vilify, for running kids into the ground, they're on to something. And it's maybe a pact with the devil, but it may be a necessary pact if you want to produce an athlete like that.
You know, it's interesting, you know, to consider the fact, though, that in spite of all of that, when you watched Mickey Mantle play baseball, and particularly in the early years before his health, the health of his body started to be an issue, he always looked like he really enjoyed the game and that he was having a lot of fun playing. And and I guess, you know, if something was forced on somebody, you might not think that they would enjoy it so much.
I think he loved baseball. I think he also loved pleasing his father, but in a way that, you know, he was he loved pleasing him. There wasn't any choice about it. He loved the attention he got, but he was also at center a very lonely man, and so you see this man who was the center of attention and had that fabulous, you know, coast to coast smile, and there was a certain freedom, I think, for him on a ball field, where he escaped the other demons that haunted him and kept him awake at night, every night haunted by nightmares after he retired, and things that just started to emerge publicly after he retired, when started to learn about the degree of his alcoholism, and then later the sexual abuse he suffered, and as I've been learning, the extent of the osteomyelitis and how close he was really to losing his leg in his teenage years. So, you know, it's an interesting thing that you can be both the center of attention and adoration, center fielder for the New York Yankees, and at the same time, a lonely man.
We have callers who want to join in the discussion this morning. Let's take a call from Jeff in Madison first. Jeff, good morning. Thanks for participating.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for the show. I want to relate an experience that I had with Mickey Mantle. I believe it was the 1962 All-Star Game, and in those days there were two All-Star Games played, and it was at Wrigley Field in Chicago, and I remember as a kid lining up at about 7:30 in the morning to get into the park at 9. They opened the bleachers to general admission, and of course it was filled with kids. And I remember in those days it was Mantle and Maris and Mays and Clemente and all the stars, Rocky Colavito and Ted Williams, all those guys, and Stan Musial, and they were all having fun with the kids in the bleachers, and they were talking to us and throwing balls in and just having a blast. And all Mickey Mantle could do was pump fake balls into the stands as kids screamed, "Mickey, Mickey, please, please." And all he could do was pump fake and not even acknowledge us. That's the only way he acknowledged us, was pump faking the ball into the stands. I thought that was mean-spirited, and it completely changed my image of him forever. So that's my experience, which wasn't too good. Another thing that I would like to ask as a question is it true that Mantle got a liver transplant when he only had maybe weeks or a month to live, and that possibly he jumped in line over people that really needed it and maybe could have had a better life?
Thanks for the question, Jeff. I just went online while you were talking, and the 62 All-Star Game was in D.C., so I'm not sure what year. I can check it while I'm talking with you here. Mantle did not jump the queue for the liver, I don't believe, and neither did a bioethicist at the University of Pennsylvania, Dr. Arthur Kaplan, who's a world-renowned expert. The surgeons that I spoke to insist that he did not. And as do the people at the Organ Bank and the Organ Procurement Agency of the government in Virginia that reviewed the transplant prior to the allocation being made. I think it's an easy conclusion to jump to because there are instances where celebrities have wrongfully jumped the queue, but I don't believe that this was the case here. Mickey was in Dallas, a locality that is one of the largest areas for organ donation. partly because Baylor, the Baylor Transplant Institute, where he had his transplant done, had done so much pioneering work in doing transplants and was so well known. And it happened that the 28-year-old man who died and who saved six lives in the process had an aneurysm, woke up, you know, one day with a headache and died. His mother didn't even know that he was an organ donor until she was informed of this after the fact. I think that from what I can tell, Mickey was lucky in the sense that he was type O blood, therefore he was eligible for the most, you know, it's a universal donor, therefore he could take an organ from anyone with A, B, B positive, whatever. And also he was the right size and dimension, and then those kinds of things matter. Everything matched up. What happened in the transplant, however, that is particularly sad, is that when they got Mantle on the table, they had done all the tests that were available to do at the time. They certainly suspected strongly and believed that he had cancer, a kind of cancer that is caused by cirrhosis of the liver, but they had also checked to make sure that he had remained sober. There was a requirement at Baylor, as there is in many hospitals across the country, that an alcoholic be sober for at least 6 months prior to being admitted to the list. But when they got him on the table, they and the pathology reports came to the surgeons during surgery, they had already taken out his old liver, which was utterly diseased and, you know, useless to him. He was a very sick man when he went into surgery. But the cancer that he had progressed far more than they realized and was of a particularly voracious type. And so they were faced with an ethical dilemma. You know, do you go ahead or do you let him bleed out on the table? Well, it wouldn't be ethical to let anybody bleed out on the table. So they went ahead and hoped for the best that chemotherapy, it was one of the few centers in the country that was treating people with transplantation and chemotherapy at the time, that they hoped it would work. And as it turned out, it didn't. I think one of the sadnesses of his death at age 63 in August 1995 is this. He had started what he liked to call Mickey's Team, and they produced these organ donation cards. It had a logo and a statement that Mickey himself created, be a donor, be a hero. Or maybe it's be a hero, be a donor. I may have it backwards. And his lawyer told him at the time, Mickey, if you do this, you know, it'll be greater than anything you've ever done on a baseball field. But unfortunately, he didn't live long enough to see it through. However, as I wrote in the book, it is not too late to join Mickey's Team. And if everyone in this country just was able to check off that they were willing to be a donor, you know, when they renewed their license, we wouldn't have waiting lists of people who really do, for a variety of reasons, have to wait much longer than he did.
Jeff, thanks for sharing that with us. Let's take a call from Matthew in Elgin.
Everybody.
Matthew, good morning.
Hi, Merry Christmas. I also have my little Mickey anecdote from the Chicago area. I could give it to you, but I have a more philosophic objection. I noticed, Jane, that you used the term pact with the devil. There's a you might know of the man who was the head of the Republicans in Congress before Newt Gingrich. His name is Robert Michael, and he's from a particular church that's in my town, which is related to Amish and Mennonite, and they don't believe in competitive sports in general. So my best friend, I didn't grow up in this type of church, but my best friend wasn't allowed to play Little League. I 100% agree with it, and I think a lot of these stories that are coming out about Mickey, who was the quintessence of sports achievement, and there's so many other stories like people like him, are little mirrors on the problem with the value of competitive sports in general, which most of Christianity does not acknowledge. That I created a soundbite, Christians should cooperate, not compete. And this church, incidentally, is also pacifistic. which Robert Michael was the sponsor of the first Gulf War resolution with Stephen Solaris from Brooklyn, but he, when you become a congressman, you can't be in the church anymore. So you want my little Mickey anecdote?
Yes, please. Right.
Okay.
Please share that.
I was 12 years old in 1967. I guess that was about the last year Mickey played in White Sox Park in Chicago, the old Comiskey Park. And Mickey was batting left-handed, and he popped up, and he kind of pounded his bat to the ground. And as a 12-year-old who had grown up on seeing Mickey Mantle, I just felt that was rather bad etiquette. I didn't use the word etiquette probably back when I was 12 years old, but I remember similar incident with Jack Nicklaus, who was microphoned and maybe hit a bad shot. And it just these, it kind of shows that it's the whole enterprise is kind of bad.
Thanks, Matthew, for sharing that with us. Gene Levy, I think he brings up a point. We kind of build up images of our sports heroes, and when we discover that they're actual human beings, that inevitably leads us to some disappointment.
Yeah, and we do that with celebrities of every kind. I mean, it's not any different. You know, the disappointment with Tiger Woods is no different than it was with John F. Kennedy, or, you know, with whichever most recent rehabbed film star. You know, we see, I mean, that's a very human thing. I think we've been doing that since mythology, you know, building up people and then either tearing them down, as people are wont to say, or watching them self-destruct. It's a funny thing. When I went to journalism school in New York at Columbia University, I had to write an admissions essay, of course, and I'd been an English major and really serious, and so I decided I would write a really serious thing about the instinct to compete and to play. And there was actually an essay called Homo Ludens, Man the Player. And there is a certain extent, excuse me, to which I think that instinct that Matthew's talking about is instinctive. I don't think you're going to weed that out of the human psyche. Do parents promote a kind of cutthroat competition at an unseemly age? And is that in the interest of the children? For most kids, no, I would say no. On the other hand, there are, you know, people who will talk about the real politic of that kind of competition and how that's the real world and kids should have, you know, get tough by that. Well, you know, it's not, doesn't appeal to me as a particular philosophy, but Mantle's intensity, you know, banging a bat against the ground does not trouble me at all. I mean, he was a very frustrated and physically debilitated man by 1967, his second to last year in the majors. He retired after the 68 season. But he, left-handed particularly, he was having extraordinary trouble getting around on a fastball or, you know, hitting that inside curve because people were purposefully throwing at his legs by that point. But that right front leg of his that was damaged so seriously and in a career-defining moment in October 1951, no longer could support the vehemence of his swing, of his left-handed swing, which was a vicious uppercut, and you could see his right leg buckling beneath him. Mickey was actually a model of comportment on the baseball field, and it's one of the things that his teammates and more particularly opponents appreciated. He didn't show anybody up. He rarely got thrown out of games. He didn't argue, you know. And in that way, he was extremely commendable.
We're talking about the latest biography of Mickey Mantle, The Last Boy, Mickey Mantle and the End of America's Childhood, with Jane Levy, the author of this work. And we'll continue that conversation in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of WPR. Stick around. More to come on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller's in after 11 o'clock. And he says, have you had your wake-up call to cut back on expenses and focus on serious savings? Well, after 11, Larry Mueller talks about investing for retirement with Frank Armstrong of Investor Solutions Incorporated. This hour we're talking about the life and times of Mickey Mantle, the last boy, Mickey Mantle, and the end of America's childhood is the biography under discussion. Jane Levy is my guest this morning. One of the things that, and you touched on this earlier, and you touch on it in the book as well, and that is that reporting on major sports figures or celebrities in general, major politicians and so forth, is quite a bit different now than it was in 1983. You might have gotten fired in 1983 for reporting something about someone like Mickey Mantle, but in 2010 you get fired for not reporting on it. Do you think, it seems to me pretty obvious that this contributes to kind of the mythic figures that we have from the history of sports, and the things that don't emerge until much, much later, but we didn't know about it then, and maybe if we had, we would have thought less of these individuals. Talk about how that culture shift maybe has shifted the way we look at celebrities today.
Well, I think that you can argue easily, and I would, that TMI, the citizen paparazzi and the, people armed with cell phones everywhere, catching people doing things that other human beings do all the time, not necessarily legally or wisely, has gone so far the opposite direction from what the culture was, not just when I was a reporter and met Mickey in 83, but also when he was coming of age and being burnished as this idol in New York. One of the days that I spent a lot of time working on and detailing is the famous Copacabana incident. It was called known as the Copa Brawl or Fracas when the Yankees got into a to-do with a bowling team from Upper Manhattan while attending a 2 a.m. Show at the Copa by Sammy Davis Jr. And, of course, it made 72-point headlines the next day in the tabloids. And the story became public, I would venture to say, because it was reported not by the sports departments, which operated by a code of omerta in those days, but by city desk reporters, by gossip columnists who were on hand that day and who reported to the city desk. I mean, in the 50s, it was see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil, and God knows, write no evil. And you can argue that that was one extreme, and the cell phone images of, Michael Phelps, say, sucking on a bong at a college party, is the other extreme. And yes, celebrities have to get used to the fact that there is no zone of privacy anymore, fair or unfair, it's a fact. But you can also turn it inside out and say, look, Mickey Mantle might have been better off had somebody been carrying a smartphone at the Copacabana, because you can bet every dime in your pocket that if had there been smartphones at the Copa in May 57, it would have been on YouTube 10 minutes after the show was over and after that bowler ended up unconscious in a back room. And I think that you can make the argument that it forms, in a way, a check and balance, that some of the recklessness that Mickey was able to get away with because of this code of omerta, had it come to light earlier, he might have had to confront some of those demons that were plaguing him. Would he have hit bottom earlier? Hard to know. But certainly we would have looked at him differently, and there wouldn't have been as much permission granted for that behavior.
We have an email from Richard who says, as a child, I lived in Welch, Oklahoma, which was about 25 miles from the Pitcher Commerce area. My grade school principal had grown up with Mickey and had played in a group known as the Whiz Kids. Could you talk about them?
Sure. That's the team that played in that ballpark by the Spring River in Baxter Springs, Kansas. And Mickey first started to play for them in 1947. He was still recovering from osteomyelitis, and he was a skinny runt of a thing. I mean, when he started high school at Commerce, he weighed 90 pounds and was on the midget basketball team. He was fast, but he wasn't the behemoth that we have come to think of him as being. There was no Joe Palooka in him back then. So he didn't really do much. In fact, they had a hard time finding a uniform that fit him in 47. In 48, after he was done with the treatment for osteomyelitis, he started to grow. And local folk, it's kind of an old wives' tale, but they believed that it was getting that penicillin in him that caused this growth spurt, because he seemed to develop overnight. And it was during the 48 season that Tom Greenway, the famous Yankee scout, stopped by the road to watch a couple of innings of a game in this ballpark. It was down in a kind of hollow next to the river. And the manager, the coach, a guy named Barney Barnett, who was famous throughout that area, had installed lights for the field. He wanted it to be as professional for his kids as possible. He knew a lot of people, and he funneled kids to scouts in the area. Excuse me. And Tom Greenway had seen the lights and stopped by. That's part of the legend. The other part of the legend is that he had really gone to see a different kid, not Mickey Mantle, a third baseman named Billy Johnson, whom he never spoke with and who never signed with the Yankees and didn't see Greenway till the mid-50s when he was pitching for the Air Force. And they had their first conversation, and Greenway said to this kid, now a man, obviously, what are you doing pitching? You know, he'd been an infielder. And the guy replied, well, somebody's got to do it. Anyway, Mickey Mantle had hit, allegedly, three balls into the Spring River. You know, that's a really good poke from home plate in that ball field, which no longer exists, by the way. And, you know, over time, those home runs got bigger and longer and more numerous. I didn't find anybody who could verify that he actually hit the balls on the fly, you know, plop, plop, fizz, fizz, into the water. You know, something might have rolled that far. But he was beginning then to show the power that would so captivate, you know, the whole nation in the 50s and 60s. But he was not by any means a you know, much coveted prospect back then. You know, he played shortstop and had a strong but errant arm. One of his first basemen, who, you know, was on the unenviable other end of catching those balls, told me about how one ball hit him in the wrist, and, you know, he threw it so hard you could see the seams of the ball in his flesh. You know, it was there were not Runt Maher, the Cardinals, was supposedly, you know, poking around, and Hugh Alexander later chased him down for the Indians and was headed off by the high school principal for reasons nobody quite knows. But that was a year later when Mickey had really come into his own and when Tom Greenway had determined to sign him for the Yankees.
Well, we're almost out of time. And I wanted to ask you before we got done, what in all your research, what did you find that surprised you the most about the life of Mickey Mantle?
Well, two things I would say. I was worried, John, that I wouldn't be able to find anything new because he had been written about so much. So I was very pleased to be able to find details about the defining injury that October 51. Everybody's heard the story about him catching his spike in a drain. Sometimes it's called a drain pipe or a faucet or whatever. In fact, what happened, I learned, was that a groundskeeper had forgotten to close the cover and to push it down tight on top of this grate embedded in the soil. And also, he never had surgery that fall. He'd always said he did, and the team doctor said he did. He didn't have any surgery until 2 years later, at which point all they could do was remove the torn cartilage, which had already begun to erode the surface of the joint and contribute to the lifelong problems that he would have. So Mickey Mantle played 2 years on a completely unstable, untreated knee. And he had, in all probability, suffered what doctors call the unhappy triad, torn ACL, torn MCL, torn cartilage. Today, you'd have a knee reconstruction. Back then, they didn't have the tools to diagnose it, much less fix it. So here's this young man, just 7 months into his major league career, who has the defining and turning point moment just as he's joining the major leagues and beginning to become Mickey Mantle.
And you'll have to read the biography to get the rest of the story because we're out of time. And I, Jane Levy, I really appreciate you coming on with me this morning and talking about this book. Been a fascinating conversation.
I really appreciate it. It's doing so well. I sold 23,000 books last week.
Holy smokes.
So I hope people will go out and still get it for the holidays.
Well, you know, there's still time. Rhonda Fanning produced this hour of programming. Dave Potras handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network.